This case, though it seems pretty complicated, is really fairly simple. It's been bouncing around in litigation for a long time, but in simple terms, there was a stock purchase agreement between a company called Oasis Publishing and Jurisearch. Jurisearch acquired all of the assets of Oasis Publishing, which was essentially a database research operation. Mr. Abrams was president and fiduciary of Oasis during the negotiations for the sale of the stock to Jurisearch. Sometime during the negotiations with Jurisearch, Mr. Abrams entered into a non-compete agreement with Jurisearch that paid him $10,000 a month.
Wait, wasn't that after the sale documents were signed that he entered into it?
There was some dispute, largely because Mr. Abrams refused to sort of acknowledge the timeline in which he was negotiating these agreements. But they were in parallel. The drafts that had floated back and forth were fairly close in time.
But the signed documents are after the fact.
I think there's different signed documents. There were a couple of different versions or iterations of it. But it's pretty clear and undisputed that all of those were negotiated as part of the transition from the sale of the assets to Jurisearch. And in fact, in fairness to Mr. Abrams, it was contemplated that he would be employed by Jurisearch as part of this transition. The question that's before us is, I don't think there's even a dispute that he disclosed any of this, that it is quite apparent that it was undisclosed that he entered into this non-compete agreement. And it's kind of an unusual non-compete agreement because his employment contract paid him in stock and options, which is what everybody else got. But he got $10,000 a month to not compete with the company that he was employed by and to not compete with himself as a fiduciary to Oasis. So we've had a hard time figuring out why they're paying him for a non-compete during the term of his employment. It would have been understandable if they'd have paid him $10,000 a month, if you will, as an employee, and then have a non-compete attached to this. But this was almost a ruse. The employment agreement itself didn't pay him anything. He got his compensation through the non-compete agreement. And that amount is either $186,000 or $201,000 because it's not clear for Mr. Abrams what he received. There was some dispute about that. So everything in this case, all the issues in this case, turn on the question of whether or not he can do that and whether or not it was a breach of his fiduciary duty to do that without disclosing it to anybody.
And let me just interrupt you here. So breach of fiduciary duty, that was the basis for the complaint that you filed,
correct?
It's also the basis for the affirmative defense that you asserted in response to the counterclaim, correct?
Correct.
So the court entered a summary judgment on the statute of limitations saying you were barred on the fiduciary duty on your complaint.
Correct.
But you were allowed to present evidence and go forward on your affirmative defense.
Of recoupment, yes.
So are the issues that would have been litigated and decided in the complaint and the affirmative defense the same?
Exactly.
So does it matter if the summary judgment was wrongly issued?
If we have appealed the court's decision against the recoupment, now, it would be true. They are different legal theories, first of all. Recoupment has narrow applications. The lawsuit itself is not confined by the doctrine of recoupment. If the statute of limitations bar is lifted as to the claim itself, it is a merits-based claim that live or dies on the question of whether it was a breach of the fiduciary duty. So the narrow application of the residual argument left over by recoupment is different from the merits of the claim itself.
How is it different, though, if in your affirmative defense you had to prove, in order to be successful, the breach of fiduciary duty?
We did. That's why I phrased the question, Judge. Either that is a breach of fiduciary duty or not. It's not undisputed that that's what happened. That he negotiated and profited from an undisclosed non-compete agreement while he was the fiduciary and a stockholder of Oasis. Now, I would agree that if the judge had ruled as a matter of fact or law or mixed question of law or fact or whatever that would be, that that was okay, and then we'd be arguing that issue. We'd be arguing, no, that's not okay. That is a blatant, overt breach of duty in which he has to account to the shareholders for his profits. Okay? If we had ever gotten to that point, that would have been an interesting issue. But the trial court ruled, well, we're not going to look at it because it's time barred, which seems inconceivable to me. The rationale for saying it was time barred is just simply erroneous, clearly wrong under the applicable standard of care. We also claim that there was enough evidence in recoupment. That is, her conclusion that recoupment didn't lie was based upon, they're not exactly the same contract. Something that wouldn't be an issue on the merits of the claim.
Didn't she also find, though, that although there was a fiduciary duty owed, there was no breach, no causation, and no damages?
And that's clearly erroneous. If I ask the question, if I make the premise, it is undisputed that while he was a fiduciary for Oasis Publishing, David Abrams negotiated for himself an undisclosed contract that paid him $10,000 a month. Would that be a breach of fiduciary duty? It is not a question of fact. It is a question of law. It is self-evident that that is a breach of his fiduciary duty.
So if we agree there's a fiduciary duty and the dual negotiations constituted a breach of that fiduciary duty, how do we determine causation and damages?
Well, maybe I'm the only one that is not troubled by that question. It seems to me the profits that he gained from that contract are the measure of damages. He has to account for it like anybody else would account for something they profited from while they were wearing two hats. And the rule has always been they disgorge the profits.
So the money that was paid him.
So the money that was paid to him becomes constructively held on behalf of the shareholders of Oasis.
Only if it would have been profits that the shareholders themselves would have realized instead.
He profited. I guess if the answer is you can get away with it, if you can find a way to put the money in your pocket and say, well, you wouldn't have gotten it anyway, it defeats the whole purpose of saying you have a fiduciary duty. The fidelity is the issue here. All he had to do was come and say to everybody, hey, I just put 10 grand a month in my pocket as part of this deal that I made to acquire the company. And then somebody would have said, no, you're not. That's not going to happen. And the problem becomes more problematic because when they stopped paying Jurisearch stopped paying Oasis, they kept paying him. And he was negotiating on behalf of Oasis an extension of the Jurisearch notes. So not only did he have a breach of fiduciary duty, he continued to negotiate on behalf of Oasis the extension of the promissory notes while he continued to receive his payments, which is something he shouldn't have done.
And there's your damages?
It's at least what he received. All we had is what, $50,000 or $60,000 or whatever the number was left to pay him under our obligation? So the amount he received under the employment or the non-compete agreement far exceeded anything that he owed him. So I still believe that the merits-based claim that he has to account for the shareholders of Oasis for the profits he got from the undisclosed non-compete agreement was not barred by the statute of limitations, and there should have been a trial of the merits of that claim.
At the end of the day, if Jurisearch pays all that they're supposed to pay to the former shareholders, are they getting everything that they were entitled to?
Well, now you've reached the complicated area. Because if you...
And I'm sorry, you only have 2 minutes.
The answer is, because everything crashed and burned in the middle and there were lawsuits, more lawsuits than I can even remember, even though I was involved in most of them, the whole deal collapsed. And the stock options went away and all sorts of other things went away, and they negotiated a settlement of the promissory note, so nobody is going to get what they were expected to get under the original agreement. So it's not possible that the shareholders would get full recovery under the original agreement. And if Mr. Qualsett wants to come in and argue on the merits, and Mr. Abrams want to come in and argue on the merits of the breach suit, whether or not there was, what was the measure of damage? Was it the full $188,000? Was it a portion of it that he earned while he was still negotiating? That would go to the merits of how much money Mr. Abrams owes the Oasis shareholders. That is where this lawsuit belongs. My effort to keep it in recoupment is hamstrung by a couple of legal principles. And that has to do with the and I think it was. I think anybody that says that the stock purchase agreement isn't the agreement that the fiduciary duty arose under and isn't the agreement that gives rise to the recoupment, that's plainly wrong. And we proved the breach, self-evident by the existence of the contract, which Mr. Abrams doesn't claim was disclosed, and the amount of money he received. Thank you.
I just want to hold you over for, because I want to go back to one of my original questions. If we were to find that the trial court erred on the recoupment issue, if we were to find one that arose out of the same transaction and there was a duty of breach, causation, and damages, would you need to proceed on your summary judgment argument?
Well, that one just gets Mr. Abrams off the hook. The other one, he may owe us money. That's the difference. At the very least, we think it's a wash. He owes us far more than we owe him, if you will.
So it'd be dollars?
Dollars. That's it would the be difference. The difference okay. between he owes the shareholders money as opposed to the shareholders don't owe him anymore.
Okay. Thank you.
How much time do we take, counsel, over? Okay. Do you want to add a minute to counsel's counsel for appellees time? You'll have 11 minutes.
Good morning. Court. My name is John Hahn. Your Honors, Mr. Zimmerman, my former partner, was the principal attorney that has handled this motion. Fortunately for you. Your Honors, I believe this appeal is on record, and I believe that Judge Stacy was correct in findings and her determinations. Initially, I need to take exception to Mr. Krieger's statement. There was no disclosure of this deed. In June of 2001 and in November of 2001, which Mr. Clausette was part of a meeting which incorporated on a private offering, clearly, explicitly disclosed the non-compete, disclosed the employment agreement with Mr. Abrams. So his statement in the testimony was, yes, I attended this meeting. Yes, I was a part of this private offering. But no, there was no discussion of non-compete. The actual records, documents, clearly show this non-compete was closed in 2001.
But doesn't his denial of what those records state create a issue of fact for the summary judgment?
Well, it doesn't, Your Honor, because the records and the testimony of Mr. Smith clearly established that everything was discussed. His statement that it was not discussed, totally incredible. I mean,
but we can't, a trial court can't weigh credibility on a summary judgment motion, can it?
Well, I think if the facts which are presented to the judge clearly show that his belief is not credible and all of the other evidence, documentary evidence, contradict a belief, then I believe the court has an absolute duty to enter something. Simply because he fabricates this notion that it was a big meeting, nothing was discussed at this time. But the records, actual minutes of the records, the private offering, clearly show that this was disclosed, terms, conditions, and everything. So, in my opinion, Your Honor, I think Judge Stacy did a very good job of determining the facts, establishing a detailed analysis of facts that were presented, time not only of the summary judgment, but also the trial itself. And first, well, secondly, Mr. Krieger indicates that there is an admission there's a breach of fiduciary duty. We disagree with that. I don't think there's been any finding whatsoever that there was a duty. So the premise that Mr. Krieger talks about is, well, is there and should we try that? Well, the matter of the fact is number one, there was not an insurance bar about statute of limitations, and recoupment clearly does not apply. Mr. Clausette contracted with this last settlement with Jurisearch. He contracted and made that negotiation that would provide for some payment to stockholders. So it seems ridiculous to me. Mr. Kwasak can now say, we've been damaged because of non-compete after he negotiated the final settlement with Jurisearch. It's just totally inconsistent. And for those reasons, Your Honor, I believe that the court should affirm the decision of Judge Stacy, and Mr. Abrams should be entitled to receive his judgment.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Krieger. The issue of whether a fiduciary duty was breached was the central issue in the complaint that Judge Stacy decided was barred by the statute of limitations, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
The equitable recoupment defense, the affirmative defense asserted in response to the counterclaim, that issue was also whether he breached his fiduciary duty.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if we were to analyze only the equitable defense and find that there was no breach, do we need to still address, or find that there was a breach? If we find there was a breach under the defense, do we need to still address the summary judgment? Or does it not matter because it's the same issue?
I think it's the same issue. And I think Judge Stacy, I think she determined in her order that there was not a breach.
Right. She found a duty, but no breach, no damages, no causation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that the plaintiff in this case failed to prove all the elements of that. So to me, Your Honor, I think she's correct. Thank you.
There being no other questions, thank you both, counsel. You're excused. Next matter is In Re Interest, Kylie P. Again, this is In Re Interest of Kylie P.